A senior-looking Chimmy, bespectacled and serious, motioned the others back to work and introduced herself.
"I am Dr. Sue," she said. "At the center, I worked on gorilla genetic histories."
Robert nodded.
"Dr. Sue, yes. I recall you helped treat my injuries."
He remembered her face peering over him through a fog while the infection raged hot through his lymphatic system.
"You were very sick, Captain Oneagle. It wasn't just your badly fractured arm, or those fungal toxins you absorbed during your accident. We are now fairly certain you also inhaled traces of the Gubru coercion gas back when they dosed the Mendoza Freehold."
Robert blinked. The memory was a blur. He had been on the mend, up in the Mendoza's mountain ranch, where he and Fibbon had spent a couple of days talking, making plans. Somehow they would find others and try to get something started. Maybe make contact with his mother's government in exile, if it still existed. Reports from Athaklena told of a set of caves that seemed ideal as a headquarters of sorts. Maybe these mountains could be a base of operations against the enemy. Then, one afternoon, there were suddenly frantic Chims running everywhere. Before Robert could speak, before he could even stand, they had plucked him up and carried him bodily out of the farmhouse and up into the hills. There were sonic booms, terse images of something immense in the sky.
But I thought the gas was fatal if...
His voice trailed off.
"If there's no antidote, yes, but your dose was so small."
Dr. Sue shrugged.
"As it is, we nearly lost you."
Robert shivered.
"What about the little girl?" "She is with the gorillas,"
the Chim nutritionist smiled.
"She's as safe as anyone can be these days."
He sighed and sat back a little.
"That's good, at least."
The Chims carrying little April Wu must have got up to the heights in plenty of time. Apparently, Robert barely made it. The Mendozas had been slower still and were caught in the stinking cloud that spilled from the belly of the alien ship. Dr. Sue went on.
"The Rillas don't like the caves, so most of them are up in the high valleys, foraging in small groups under loose supervision, away from any buildings. Structures are still being gassed regularly, you know, whether they contain humans or not."
Robert nodded. "The Gubru are being thorough." He looked at the wall board stuck with multicolored pins. The map covered the entire region from the mountains north across the Vale of Sind and west to the sea. There the islands of the archipelago made a necklace of civilization. Only one city lay on shore, Port Helena, on the northern verge of Aspinall Bay. South and east of the Mulun Mountains lay the wilds of the main continent, but the most important feature was depicted along the top edge of the map. Patient, perhaps unstoppable, the great gray sheets of ice encroached lower every year, the final bane of Garth. The map pins, however, dealt with a much closer, nearer-term calamity. It was easy to read the array of pink and red markers.
"They've really got a grip on things, haven't they?"
The elderly Chim named Micah brought Robert a glass of water. He frowned at the map also.
"Yes, sir. The fighting seems to all be over. The Gubru have been concentrating their energies around the port and the archipelago so far. There's been little activity here in the mountains, except this perpetual harassment by robots dropping coercion gas. But the enemy has established a firm presence every place that was colonized."
"Where do you get your information?"
"Mostly from invader broadcasts and censored commercial stations in Port Helena. The general also sent runners and observers off in all directions. Some of them have reported back already."
"Who's got runners?"
"The gen...
Micah looked a bit embarrassed.
Some of the Chims find it hard to pronounce Miss Athic. Miss Athiclena's name, sir. So, well...
His voice trailed off. Robert sniffed. I'm going to have a talk with that girl, he thought. He lifted his water glass and asked,
Who did she send to Port Helena? That's going to be a touchy place for a spy to get into.
Dr. Sue answered without much enthusiasm.
Athiclena chose a chim named Fibbin Bulger.
Robert coughed, spraying water over his robe. Dr. Sue hurried on.
He is a militiaman, Captain, and Miss Athiclena figured that spying around in town would require an unconventional approach.
That only made Robert cough harder. Unconventional. Yes, that described Fibbin. If Athiclena had chosen old Trog Bulger for that mission, then it spoke well for her judgment. She might not be stumbling in the dark after all.
Still, she's hardly more than a kid, and an alien at that. Does she actually think she's a general? Commanding what?
He looked around the sparsely furnished cavern, the small heaps of scrounged and hand-carried supplies. It was, all told, a pitiful affair.
That wall map arrangement is pretty crude, Robert observed, picking out one thing in particular.
An elderly Chen, who hadn't spoken yet, rubbed the sparse hair on his chin.
We could organize much better than this, he agreed. We've got several mid-size computers. A few Chims are working programs on batteries, but we don't have the power to run them at full capacity.
He looked at Robert archly.
Timbrimmy Athiclena insists we drill a geothermal tap first, but I figure if we were to set up a few solar collectors on the surface, very well hidden, of course.
He let the thought hang. Robert could tell that one Chim, at least, was less than thrilled at being commanded by a mere girl, and one who wasn't even of Earth Clan or Terrigan's citizenship. What's your name?
Jobert, Captain.
Robert shook his head.
Well, Jobert, we can discuss that later. Right now, will someone please tell me about this raid? What is Athiclena up to?
Micah and Sue looked at each other. The Chimmy spoke first.
They left before dawn. It's already late afternoon outside. We should be getting a runner in any time now.
Jobert grimaced again, his wrinkled, age-darkened face dour with pessimism.
They went out armed with pin rifles and concussion grenades, hoping to ambush a Gubru patrol.
Actually, the elderly Chim added dryly, we were expecting news more than an hour ago. I'm afraid they are already very late getting back.
Chapter 26 Fibbin. Fibbin awoke in darkness, fetal curled under a dusty blanket. Awareness brought back the pain. Just pulling his right arm away from his eyes took a stoic effort of will, and the movement set off a wave of nausea. Unconsciousness beckoned him back seductively. What made him resist was the filmy, lingering tracery of his dreams. They had driven him to seek consciousness, those weird, terrifying images and sensations. The last vivid scene had been a cratered desert landscape. Lightning struck the stark sands all around him, pelting him with charged, sparking shrapnel, whichever way he tried to duck or hide. He recalled trying to protest, as if there were words that might somehow placate a storm, but speech had been taken from him. By effort of will, Fibbin managed to roll over on the creaking cot. He had to knuckle-rub his eyes before they would open, and then all they made out was the dimness of a shabby little room. A thin line of light traced the overlap of heavy black curtains covering a small window. His muscles trembled spasmodically. Fibbon remembered the last time he had felt anywhere near this lousy, back on Silmar Island. A band of neo-chimp circus entertainers from Earth had dropped in to do a show. The visiting strong man offered to wrestle the college champion, and, like an idiot, Fibbon had accepted. It had been weeks before he walked again without a limp. Fibbon groaned and sat up. His inner thighs burned like fire.
"Oh, Mama," he moaned. "I'll never scissors hold again."
His skin and body hair were moist. Fibbon sniffed the pungent odor of Dalcebo, a strong muscle relaxant. So at least his captors had taken efforts to spare him the worst after-effects of stunning. Still, his brain felt like a misbehaving gyroscope when he tried to rise. Fibbon grabbed the teetering bedside table for support as he stood up, and held his side while he shuffled over to the solitary window. He grabbed rough fabric on both sides of the thin line of light and snapped the drapes apart. Immediately Fibbon stumbled back, both arms raised to ward off the sudden brightness. After-images whirled.
"Ah!"
he commented succinctly. It was barely a croak. What was this place? Some prison of the Gubru? Certainly he wasn't aboard an invader battleship. He doubted the fastidious Galactics would use native wood furnishings or decorate in late antediluvian shabby. He lowered his arms, blinking away tears. Through the window he saw an enclosed yard, an unkempt vegetable garden, a couple of climbing trees. It looked like a typical small commune house, the sort a Chim group marriage family might own. Just visible over the nearby roofs, a line of hilltop eucalyptus trees told him he was still in Port Helena, not far from Sea Bluff Park. Perhaps the Gubru were leaving his interrogation to their quislings, or his captors could be those hostile probationers. They might have their own plans for him. Fibbon's mouth felt as if dust weavers had been spinning traps in it. He saw a water pitcher on the room's only table. One cup was already poured. He stumbled over and grabbed for it, but missed and knocked it, crashing to the floor.
"Focus," Fibbon told himself. "You want to get out of this, try to think like a member of a star-faring race."
It was hard. The sub-vocalized words were painful just behind his forehead. He could feel his mind try to retreat, to abandon Anglic for a simpler, more natural way of thinking. Fibbon resisted an almost overpowering urge to simply grab up the pitcher and drink from it directly. Instead, in spite of his thirst, he concentrated on each step involved in pouring another cup. His fingers trembled on the pitcher's handle.
"Focus."
Fibbon recalled an ancient Zen adage. Before enlightenment, chop wood, pour water. After enlightenment, chop wood, pour water. Slowing down in spite of his thirst, he turned the simple act of pouring into an exercise. Holding on with two shaking hands, Fibbon managed to pour himself about half a cupful, slopping about as much onto the table and floor. No matter. He took up the tumbler and drank in deep, greedy swallows. The second cup poured easier. His hands were steadier.
"That's it. Focus. Choose the hard path, the one using thought."
At least Chims had it easier than Neo-Dolphins. The other earthly client race was 100 years younger and had to use 3 languages in order to think at all. He was concentrating so hard that he didn't notice when the door behind him opened.
"Well, for a boy who's had such a busy night, you sure are chipper this morning."
Fibbon whirled. Water splattered the wall as he brought up the cup to throw it, but the sudden movement seemed to send his brain spinning in his head. The cup clattered to the floor, and Fibbon clutched at his temples, groaning under a wave of vertigo. Blearily, he saw a chimney in a blue sarong. She approached, carrying a tray. Fibbon fought to remain standing, but his legs folded and he sank to his knees. "Bloody fool," he heard her say. Bile in his mouth was only one reason he couldn't answer. She set her tray on the table and took hold of his arm. "Only an idiot would try to get up after taking a full stunner jolt at close range." Fibbon snarled and tried to shake her hands off. Now he remembered. This was the little pimp from the ape's grape. The one who had stood in the balcony not far from the Goobru, and who had him stunned just as he was about to make his escape.
"Let me alone," he said. "I don't need any help from a damn traitor."
At least that was what he had intended to say, but it came out more as a slurred mumble.
"Right. Anything you say," the chimney answered evenly.
She hauled him by one arm back to the bed. In spite of her slight size, she was quite strong. Fibbon groaned as he landed on the lumpy mattress. He kept trying to gather himself together, but rational thought seemed to swell and fade like ocean surf.
"I'm going to give you something. You'll sleep for at least 10 hours, then maybe you'll be ready to answer some questions."
Fibbon couldn't spare the energy to curse her. All his attention was given over to finding a focus, something to center on. Anglic wasn't good enough anymore. He tried Galactic 7.
"Na-ka-cha-kresh,"
he counted thickly.
"Yes, yes," he heard her say. "But now we're all quite aware how well-educated you are."
Fibbon opened his eyes as the chimney leaned over him, a capsule in her hand. With a finger snap, she broke it, releasing a cloud of heavy vapor. He tried to hold his breath against the anesthetic gas, knowing it was useless. At the same time, Fibbon couldn't help noticing that she was actually fairly pretty, with a small, childlike jaw and smooth skin. Only her wry, bitter smile ruined the picture.
"My, you are an obstinate Chen, aren't you? Be a good boy now. Breathe in and rest," she commanded.
Unable to hold out any longer, Fibbon had to inhale at last. A sweet odor filled his nostrils, like overripe forest fruit. Awareness began dissipating in a floating glow. It was only then Fibbon realized that she, too, had spoken in perfect, unaccented Galactic 7. Chapter 28 Government in Hiding. Megan Oneagle blinked away tears. She wanted to turn away, not to look, but she forced herself to watch the carnage one more time. The large hollow tank depicted a night scene, a rain-driven beach that shone dimly in shades of gray under faintly visible brooding cliffs. There were no moons, no stars, in fact, hardly any light at all. The enhancement cameras had been at their very limits taking these pictures. On the beach, she could barely make out 5 black shapes that crawled ashore, dashed across the sand, and began climbing the low, crumbling bluffs.
"You can tell they followed procedures precisely," Major Prophet Chulthorn of the Terrigan's Marines explained. "First, the submarine released the advance divers, who went ahead to scout and set up surveillance. Then, when it seemed the coast was clear, the sabots were released."
Megan watched as little boats bobbed to the surface, black globes rising amid small clouds of bubbles, which then headed quickly for shore. They landed, covers popped off, and more dark figures emerged. "They carried the finest equipment available. Their training was the best. These were Terrigan's Marines."
"So?" Megan shook her head. "Does that mean they did not have mothers?"
She understood what Prophet Chulthorn was saying, however. If calamity could befall these professionals, who could blame Garth's colonial militia for the disasters of the last few months? The black shapes moved toward the cliffs, stoop-shouldered under heavy burdens. For weeks now, the remnants still under Megan's command had sat with her, deep in their underwater refuge, pondering the collapse of all their well-laid plans for an organized resistance. The agents and saboteurs had been ready, the arms caches and cells organized. Then came the cursed Goobru coercion gas, and all their careful schemes collapsed under those roiling clouds of deadly smoke. What few humans remained on the mainland were certainly dead by now, or as good as dead. What was frustrating was that nobody, not even the enemy in their broadcasts, seemed to know who or how many had made it to the islands in time for antidote treatment and internment. Megan avoided thinking about her son. With any luck, he was now on Silmar Island, brooding with his friends in some pub, or complaining to a crowd of sympathetic girls how his mother had kept him out of the war. She could only hope and pray that was the case, and that Utha Kalding's daughter was safe as well. More of a cause for perplexity was the fate of the Timbrimi ambassador himself. Utha Kalding had promised to follow the Planetary Council into hiding, but he had never appeared. There were reports that his ship had tried for deep space instead, and was destroyed.
So many lives. Lost to what purpose?
Megan watched the display as the Sabbats began edging back into the water. The main force of men was already climbing the bluffs. Without humans, of course, any hope of resistance was out of the question. A few of the cleverest chims might strike a blow here or there, but what could actually be expected of them without their patrons? One purpose of this landing had been to start something going again, to adapt and adjust to new circumstances. For the third time, even though she knew it was coming, Megan was caught by surprise as lightning suddenly burst upon the beach. In an instant, everything was bathed in brilliant colors. First to explode were the little boats, the Sabbats. Next came the men. The sub pulled its camera in and dived just in time. Major Pratha Chulthorn said. The display went blank. The woman Marine Lieutenant who had operated the projector turned on the lights. The other members of the Council blinked, adjusting to the light. Several dabbed their eyes. Major Pratha Chulthorn's South Asian features were darkly serious as he spoke again. It's the same thing as during the space battle, and when they somehow knew to gas every secret base we'd set up on land. Somehow they always find out where we are.
Do you have any idea how they're doing it?
One of the council members asked. Vaguely, Megan recognized that it was the female Marine officer, Lieutenant Lydia McHugh, who answered. The young woman shook her head.
We have all of our technicians working on the problem, of course, but until we have some idea how they're doing it, we don't want to waste any more men trying to sneak ashore.
Megan On Eagle closed her eyes.
I think we are in no condition now to discuss matters any further. I declare this meeting adjourned.
When she retired to her tiny room, Megan thought she would cry. Instead, though, she merely sat on the edge of her bed, in complete darkness, allowing her eyes to look in the direction she knew her hands lay. After a while, she felt she could almost see them, fingers like blobs resting tiredly on her knees. She imagined they were stained, a deep, sanguinary red. Chapter 29 Robert. Deep underground, there was no way to sense the natural passage of time. Still, when Robert jerked awake in his chair, he knew exactly when it was.
Late. Too damn late.
Athaclena was due back hours ago. If he weren't still little more than an invalid, he would have overcome the objections of Micah and Dr. Sue and gone topside himself, looking for the long-overdue raiding party. As it was, the two Chim scientists had nearly had to use force to stop him. Traces of Robert's fever still returned now and then. He wiped his forehead and suppressed some momentary shivers.
No, he thought. I am in control.
He stood up and picked his way carefully toward the sounds of muttered argument, where he found a pair of Chims working over the pearly light of a salvaged Level 17 computer. Robert sat on a packing crate behind them and listened for a while. When he made a suggestion, they tried it, and it worked. Soon he had almost managed to push aside his worries as he immersed himself in work, helping the Chims sketch out military tactics programming for a machine that had never been designed for anything more hostile than chess. Somebody came by with a pitcher of juice. He drank. Someone handed him a sandwich. He ate. An indeterminate time later, a shout echoed through the underground chamber. Feet thumped hurriedly over low wooden bridges. Robert's eyes had grown accustomed to the bright screen, so it was out of a dark gloom that he saw Chims hurrying past, seizing assorted odd-lot weapons as they rushed up the passage, leading to the surface. He stood and grabbed at the nearest running brown form. "What's happening?" He might as well have tried to halt a bull. The Chim tore free without even glancing his way and vanished up the ragged tunnel. The next one he waved down actually looked at him and halted restlessly.
"It's the expedition," the nervous Chen explained. "They've come back. At least, I hear some of them have."
Robert let the fellow go. He began casting around the chamber for a weapon of his own. If the raiding party had been followed back here... There wasn't anything handy, of course. He realized bitterly that a rifle would hardly do him any good with his right arm immobilized. The Chims probably wouldn't let him fight anyway. They'd more likely carry him bodily out of harm's way, deeper into the caves. For a while there was silence. A few elderly Chims waited with him for the sound of gunfire. Instead, there came voices, gradually growing louder. The shout sounded more excited than fearful. Something seemed to stroke him, just above the ears. He hadn't had much practice since the accident, but now Robert's simple empathy sense felt a familiar trace blow into the chamber. He began to hope. A babbling crowd of figures turned the bend, ragged, filthy neo-chimpanzees carrying slung weapons, some sporting bandages. The instant he saw Athoclena, a knot seemed to let go inside of Robert. Just as quickly, though, another worry took its place. The Timbrimi girl had been using the gear transformation, clearly. He felt the rough edges of her exhaustion, and her face was gaunt. Moreover, Robert could tell that she was still hard at work. Her corona stood puffed out, sparkling without light. The Chims hardly seemed to notice as stay-at-homes eagerly pumped the jubilant raiders for news, but Robert realized that Athoclena was concentrating hard to craft that mood. It was too tenuous, too tentative, to sustain itself without her.
"Robert!"
Her eyes widened.
"Should you be out of bed? Your fever only broke yesterday."
"I'm fine, but..."
"Good. I'm happy to see you ambulatory at last."
Robert watched as two heavily bandaged forms were rushed past on stretchers toward their makeshift hospital. He sensed Athoclena's effort to divert attention away from the bleeding, perhaps dying, soldiers until they were out of sight. Only the presence of the Chims made Robert keep his voice low and even.
"I want to talk with you, Athoclena."
She met his eyes. And for a brief instant, Robert thought he kenned a faint form turning and whirling above the floating tendrils of her corona. It was a harried glyph. The returning warriors were busy with food and drink, bragging to their eager peers. Only Benjamin, a hand-sewn lieutenant's patch on his arm, stood soberly beside Athoclena. She nodded.
"Very well, Robert.
Let us go someplace private.
Let me guess, he said levelly. You got your asses kicked. Jim Benjamin winced, but he did not disagree. He tapped a spot on an outstretched map.
We hit them here, in Yenching Gap, he said. It was our fourth raid, so we thought we knew what to expect.
Your fourth? Robert turned to Athaclena. How long has this been going on? She had been picking daintily at a pocket pastry filled with something pungently aromatic. She wrinkled her nose.
We have been practicing for about a week, Robert, but this was the first time we tried to do any real harm.
And? Benjamin seemed immune to Athaclena's mood tailoring. Perhaps it was intentional, for she would need at least one aide whose judgment was unaffected. Or maybe he was just too bright. He rolled his eyes.
We're the ones who got hurt.
He went on to explain.
We split into five groups. Ms. Athaclena insisted. It's what saved us.
What was your target?
A small patrol, two light hover tanks, and a couple of open land cars.
Robert pondered the site on the map, where one of the few roads entered the first rank of mountains. From what others had told him, the enemy were seldom seen above the Sind. They seemed content to control space, the archipelago, and the narrow strip of settlement along the coast around Port Helena. After all, why should they bother with the backcountry? They had nearly every human safely locked away. Garth was theirs. Apparently, the rebels' first three forays had been exercises, a few former militia non-coms among the Chims trying to teach raw recruits how to move and fight under the forest shadows. Fourth time out, though, they had felt ready to contact the enemy.
From the beginning, they seemed to know we were there, Benjamin continued. We followed them as they patrolled, practiced ducking through the trees and keeping them in sight, like before. Then
you actually attacked the patrol. Benjamin nodded.
We suspected they knew where we were, but we had to be sure. The general came up with a plan.
Robert blinked, then nodded. He still wasn't used to Athaclena's new honorary title. His puzzlement grew as he listened to Benjamin describing this morning's action. The ambush had been set up so five different parties would each, in turn, get a shot at the patrol with minimum risk, and without much chance to damage the enemy either, he noted. The ambuscades were mostly too high or too far away to offer very good shots. With hunting rifles and concussion grenades, what harm could they do? One small Gubru land car had been destroyed in the initial fusillade. Another was lightly damaged before withering fire from the tanks forced each squad into retreat. Air cover arrived swiftly from the coast, and the raiders fled barely in time. The aggressive portion of the raid was finished in less than 15 minutes. The retreat and circuitous covering of tracks took much longer. The Gubru weren't fooled, were they? Robert asked. Benjamin shook his head.
They always seem to be able to pick us out. It's a miracle we were able to ding them at all, and a bigger one we got away.
Robert glanced at the general. He started to voice his disapproval, but then he looked back at the map one more time, pondering the positions the ambushers had taken up. He traced the lines of fire, the avenues of retreat.
You suspected as much, he said at last to Athaclena.
Her eyes came slightly together and separated again, a timbrimy shrug.
I did not think we should approach too closely on our first encounter.
Robert nodded. Indeed, if closer, better ambush sites had been chosen, few, if any, of the Chims would have made it back alive. The plan was good. No, not good. Inspired. It hadn't been intended to hurt the enemy, but to build confidence.
The troops had been dispersed, so everyone would get to fire at the patrol with minimum risk. The raiders could return home swaggering, but most important, they would make it home. Even so, they had been hurt. Robert could sense how exhausted Athaclena was, partly from the effort of maintaining everyone's mood of victory. He felt a touch on his knee and took Athaclena's hand in his own. Her long, delicate fingers closed tightly, and he felt her triple-beat pulse. Their eyes met.
"We turned a possible disaster into a minor success today," Benjamin said. "But so long as the enemy always knows where we are, I don't see how we can ever do more than play tag with them. And even that game will certainly cost more than we can afford to pay."
Chapter 30 Thibin. Thibin rubbed the back of his neck and stared irritably across the table. So this was the person he had been sent to contact, Dr. Taka's brilliant student, their would-be leader of an urban underground.
"What kind of idiocy was that?" he accused. "You let me walk into that club blind, ignorant. There were a dozen times I nearly got caught last night, or even killed."
"It was two nights ago," Gaylett Jones corrected him. She sat in the straight-backed chair and smoothed the blue demi-silk of her sarong. "Anyway, I was there at the Ape's Grape, waiting outside to make contact. I saw that you were a stranger, arriving alone, wearing a plaid work shirt, so I approached you with the password."
"Pink?" Thibin blinked at her. "You come up to me and whisper pink at me? And that's supposed to be a bloody reverted password?"
Normally, he would never use such rough language with a young lady. Right now, Gaylett Jones looked more like the sort of person he had expected in the first place, a chimney of obvious education and breeding. But he had seen her under other circumstances, and he wasn't ever likely to forget.
"You call that a password? They told me to look for a fisherman."
Shouting made him wince. Thibin's head still felt as though it were leaking brains in five or six places. His muscles had stopped cramping capriciously some time ago, but he still ached all over, and his temper was short.
"A fisherman? In that part of town?"
Gaylett Jones frowned, her face clouding momentarily.
"Listen, everything was chaos when I rang up the center to leave word with Dr. Taka. I figured her group was used to keeping secrets and would make an ideal core out in the countryside. I only had a few moments to think up a way to make a later contact before the Gubru took over the telephone lines. I figured they were already tapping and recording everything, so it had to be something colloquial, you know, that their language computers would have trouble interpreting."
She stopped suddenly, bringing her hand to her mouth.
"Oh, no."
"What?" Thibin edged forward. She blinked for a moment, then motioned in the air.
"I told that fool operator at the center how their emissary should dress and where to meet me. Then I said I'd pass myself off as a hooker."
"As a what? I don't get it." Thibin shook his head.
"It's an archaic term. Pre-contact human slang for one who offers cheap, illicit sex for cash."
Thibin snapped.
"Of all the damn fool, if-me-cursed, loony ideas!"
Gaylett Jones answered back hotly.
"All right, smarty, what should I have done? The militia was falling to pieces. Nobody had even considered what to do if every human on the planet was suddenly removed from the chain of command. I had this wild notion of helping to start a resistance movement from scratch. So I tried to arrange a meeting." "Uh-huh. Posing as someone advertising illicit favors right outside a place where the Gubru were inciting a sexual frenzy. How was I to know what they were going to do, or that they'd choose that sleepy little club as the place to do it in? I conjectured that social restraints would relax enough to let me pull the pose
and so be able to approach strangers. It never occurred to me they'd relax that much. My guess was that anyone I came up to by mistake would be so surprised he'd act as you did, and I could pull a fade.
But it didn't work out that way.
No, it did not. Before you appeared, several solitary chins showed up, dressed likely enough to make me put on my act. Poor Max had to stun half a dozen of them, and the alley was starting to get full. But it was already too late to change the rendezvous or the password.
Which nobody understood. Hooker? You should have realized something like that would get garbled.
I knew Dr. Taka would understand. We used to watch and discuss old movies together. We'd study the archaic words they used. I can't understand why she...
Her voice trailed off when she saw the expression on Fibbin's face.
What? Why are you looking at me like that?
I'm sorry, I just realized that you couldn't know.
He shook his head.
You see, Dr. Taka died just about the time they got your message, of an allergic reaction to the coercion gas.
Her breath caught. Galet seemed to sink into herself.
I feared as much when she didn't show up in town for internment. It's a great loss.
She closed her eyes and turned away, obviously feeling more than her words told. At least she had been spared witnessing the flaming end of the Howlett Center as the soot-covered ambulances came and went, and the glazed, dying face of her mentor as the ecdemic gas took its cruel statistical toll. Fibbin had seen recordings of that fear-palled evening. The images lay in dark layers still at the back of his mind. Galet gathered herself, visibly putting off her mourning for later. She dabbed her eyes and faced Fibbin, jaw out-thrust defiantly.
"I had to come up with something a Chim would understand, but the E.T.'s language computers wouldn't. It won't be the last time we have to improvise. Anyway, what matters is that you are here. Our two groups are in contact now."
"I was almost killed," he pointed out, though this time he felt a bit churlish for mentioning it.
"But you weren't killed. In fact, there may be ways to turn your little misadventure into an advantage. Out on the streets, they're still talking about what you did that night, you know."
Was that a faint, tentative note of respect in her voice? A peace offering, perhaps? Suddenly, it was all too much, much too much for him. Fibbin knew it was exactly the wrong thing to do at exactly the wrong time, but he just couldn't help himself. He broke up.
"Ah, Hook?"
He giggled, though every shake seemed to rattle his brain in his skull.
"Ah, Hooker?"
He threw back his head and hooted, pounding on the arms of the chair. Fibbin slumped. He guffawed, kicking his feet in the air.
"Oh, good all. That was all I needed to be looking for."
Galet Jones glared at him as he gasped for breath. He didn't even care right now if she called in that big chim, Max, to use the stunner on him again. It was all just too much. If the look in her eyes right then counted for anything, Fibbin knew this alliance was already off to a rocky start.